Sheffield Live. Made in Sheffield. Made by you.
Wake up to something different on Sunday mornings by joining me, Pete Evans, for Spinning Jazz. The finest in modern jazz, from hard bop to bossa nova, from Latin to soul. That's Spinning Jazz every Sunday morning at 9 on Sheffield Live. 93.2 FM.
If you like rock in all its forms, you will love Glory Days. You can listen to us locally on 93.2 FM and on the telly, and anywhere in the world on sheffieldlive.org. What do you think, Don? You know what, I think he likes it. That's Glory Days, every Monday 1 till 3, here on Sheffield Live. Bosh, bosh. Oops, I've had an accident.
Hello, I'm Harry Wilburn. I present Steel & Wire every Wednesday, 10 a.m. Americana, bluegrass, American roots, and more. Lots of guests, lots of local music and musicians. That's Steel & Wire, Wednesday, 10 a.m.
You are listening to fabulous Harry Wilburn on Steel & Wire.
It's time to open the music box. Join me, Steve Roden, every Thursday morning between 10 and 12 for music from the 40s to the 90s from my own music collection. Songs I've grown up with, ones I am sure you will enjoy hearing again. Hope to see you then.
If you love new music and you want to discover the best new artists out there, then tune into The Backroom with me, Paddy. I'll be playing the best of new indie, electro, EDM and punk, and showcasing new Sheffield talent. Also music news, local and national gig guide and new album releases. So tune into The Backroom every Thursday night between 6 and 7 p.m. here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM.
This is Sheffield Live.
Listening to me, Denise, on the film show with
Martin.
Hello. Good afternoon.
Back again.
Both of us in stereo again.
This is getting too consistent for my liking. Well, maybe we'll be nicer to each other than we were last week.
We were a bit catty last week.
It was, wasn't it? Yeah. Still got the scratches down my back.
I mean, I've just looked at the schedule for today, though, and we're going to talk about France's Me Too moment in a bit, and we're probably going to row about that, aren't we?
I know, you'll be saying... Well, in fact, surely it should be moi aussi.
Moi aussi. What have you been up to this week?
I've got a DVD, I've got a Blu-ray box set of some French hard-boiled crime thrillers from the 70s. There's three of them in there.
You know how to live, Martin.
I do. You know, people say, oh, that guy, he's so cool. But I watched a really good one last night called Série Noire, which is an adaptation of Jim Thompson's a hell of a woman, and it's a really scuzzy, nasty little movie with a absolutely amazing performance from Patrick DeWere. And it's one of the best adaptations of a Jim Thompson novel that I've ever seen.
Oh, that sounds good.
And I've got the other two to go. And I've just really enjoyed it. I'm watching all the extras as well, because a lot of the stuff I'm not that familiar with about the production side.
Well, because I'm reviewing The End, I wanted to finally catch the film of about 10 years ago, the documentary Joshua Oppenheimer made, The Act of Killing.
Oh, The Act of Killing,
that was my Friday night. I mean, that was my double bill. Basically, I went home and watched that.
You went home and watched The Act of Killing.
Well, there was a theatrical cut, which was just under, I think, 2 hours. And then a director's cut that was 2 hours 50, and I was like, I can't. Normally I'd always go for the director's cut, and I was like, I don't think I can watch 2 hours 50 of this. But then I just ate up all the extras afterwards.
It's a grueling film, isn't it? One of those that gives you sort of no hope for humanity almost, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's so bizarre.
And I don't think we have in the West the concept of what happened in Indonesia as much as other...
I mean, sorry, we probably should explain. It's about
the
going back to Indonesia.
1960. So this is filmed over like 8 years up to, it was released in like 2014, I think, something like that. But it's about the 1965-1966 military coup when they took over a left-wing government.
Suharto, who was the guy from home.
You wanted me to have read as if I was going to write an essay on it, and I don't remember names like that. But, anyone left-wing, intellectual, Chinese, you know, they think... They don't know the number of people that were murdered, but it's in the million mark.
Yeah.
It's a ridiculously underreported in the West affair, because I think at the time the West were reporting it because, of course, this was beating the communists, so it's a fascinating film to watch.
Well, he goes back and he gets these guys who worked in the secret police and these death squads.
They were gangsters, basically, hired by the military police.
And they reenact what they did, and he films it as sort
with
of
no shame or compunction.
And they're having a great time doing it.
And then it, as it goes on, it gets more. They get more elaborate in their filming, and they want more effects and makeup, and
they want a bigger budget. You know, it's almost as though they get seduced by the glamour of cinema, isn't it?
Yeah, well, one of them. It was really interesting watching it before The End as well, which I'll talk about a bit more later. But there is this musical element to it as well.
Yeah.
And this performance element, and him being obsessed. There's a central guy called Anwar Kongo who's now since died, but he goes on this. It starts to niggle him. And he starts to, he talks about some of the dreams that he has, and he, you know, he's laughing about it at first, but by the end, you're wondering what he's really thinking.
Is he the one that breaks down at the end?
Yeah.
I mean, not that I have any sympathy for him.
No, absolutely not, but they do two scenes with him in the same place where at first he's describing how he got a more effective way of killing because it was getting too messy and bloody. We don't want that much blood. But then later he goes back to that scene and he just physically retches.
Yeah.
And it's a really, really interesting and compelling film. So that was my cheery Friday night.
That's lovely.
Chris just opened the drawer in the living room and was like, what are you... Oh, God, what are you
should have followed a really grim, grimy French thriller from
Happy
the 90s.
Happy Friday, everyone.
I know just what I feel like tonight. Okay, news. In France, Gérard Depardieu has been on trial this week for allegations.
This has been a long time
sexual
coming.
Sexual assault, yeah. These stories have been around for several years and they've finally reached the courts. And France has always seemed to have a slightly different attitude to this sort of thing, which I've never quite really got my head round why that is. So as we were saying, this is maybe the moi aussi moment for French culture.
Well, they were very
culture.
Dismissive. Lots of big names in French culture were very dismissive about the Me Too moment.
Yes.
When it happened.
Yeah.
You know.
It's like, well, we sort of don't know do that in France. We have a different attitude to it. I mean, Polanski has lived and worked in France for most of
If you put these great men on a platform of, you know, untouchability and license to...
I mean, it's all pretty like a very sort of low life what he's done. It's just like fondling and harassing women on set, and if they complain, turning around and saying, "Oh, you'll never make it in this business if you're going to be like that." It's so depressingly familiar. I think is what I felt more than anything else reading it. I mean, I was wondering whether all the coverage there has been in over the past 18 months, 2 years on the Gisele Picot trial has really changed a lot of people's attitudes towards
that into context. That was a lady in, I believe she's in her 70s, who found out that her husband had been
drugging her and inviting strangers to his home to rape her and film it and record it. And his daughter is now taking him to court because she believes he actually.
But the French judicial system is sort of quite different to ours, and a different sort of thing to get your head around about how they investigate crime and try it. But she had to become this sort of figurehead for justice and try and change the narrative of, like, I haven't done anything wrong. I am the victim, and I am. this is the perpetrator.
And that was a very hard thing to even get that idea put forward and accepted. Well, that's how things should be. So I think Depardieu's... the case is going to reach... there's going to be a judgment in May.
Yeah.
But he says that he's also eager to get back to work because he hasn't acted for 3 years.
Poor Gerard. It's so on a just a personal level of loving French cinema over like the 80s and 90s. You can't, there aren't films that haven't got his influence in them, and it just taints that whole relationship between, like, so for example, I love Jean de Fleckman and de Source. I went to see them at the cinema when they came out. Made me really get interested in French cinema, and it's a big sort of big budget affair. I love the book, and now I've got this feeling in the back of my head that I don't have that strong love for it anymore because of what I know he is now.
And it's strange. I mean, this is a really big question. Do you judge a piece of art on the person who has made it or has been in it if you find out something about
I suppose it depends on the thing and how long it was going on, and just knowing that it was known about then and just ignored and brushed up aside.
It's one of those very, very complicated questions, isn't it? And again, it's almost like you feel as though you have to take each case on its own, say merits and demerits, let's say. But yes, I'm sure it might be something we'll come back to talk about again at some point.
Yeah. But also, just before we leave it,
yeah.
there's a thing where, like, he's been given Russian citizenship as well, hasn't he? Vladimir Putin.
Putin gave him Russian citizenship.
He loves the Russian spirit.
And he feels that he has Russian in him. But they fell out a couple of years ago when Russia invaded Ukraine. Yeah. And they had a big row and... Now he hasn't got any Russian spirit in him anymore. So there you are.
Oh, dear. What's next? Have we got anything cheery?
No, we haven't. I'm looking back. There's no light moments in this.
Oh, dear. Sorry, guys.
this was the story about the... one of the directors of this year's Oscar-winning No Other Land, which was... Hamdan Bilal, who is a Palestinian. There was also an Israeli director who co-directed it with him, and I can't find his name. And the photo I've got doesn't have the director's name here, but I'll call it up in a minute. He was in the West Bank, and he was attacked by Israeli settlers. And when the army arrived to maybe ostensibly stop the beatings and attacks, they promptly arrested him, beat him up some more, and threw him into jail. All because it was known that he was the director of this film, No Other Land. Incredible story. I mean, you just can't really get your head around some of this stuff that's going on out there. And the film had also come under attack in the United States, where it had been shown at an independent cinema in Miami Beach. A small cinema called the O Cinema, which is a very well-known independent art house cinema. And the mayor of Miami Beach wanted to withdraw the cinema's lease for the property it was on because it had screened No Other Land with accusations that the film was anti-Semitic, even though it's a very even-handed look at a community trying to come together. Palestinians and Israelis trying to find a common purpose. And he was trying to close the cinema down and take away the cinema's lease. I think that has been stopped. But it is just incredible how little voice there is for the Palestinian side, it seems to me. In America, certainly,
when someone speaks up, it's kind of squashed, isn't it?
Israel, and in some cases, even sometimes in this country. So, another very disappointing story.
I think No Other Land is streaming on Channel 4 as
well. If you want to get it's a marvelous film. Bilal al-Huraini is actually free again now. And I think just recovering from the injuries that he received from the settlers and the Israeli army. Sorry about that. Have we got anything?
Trailer trash doesn't look massively cheery either.
It doesn't look very cheery. This is the new Paul Thomas Anderson film.
One Battle After Another.
One Battle After Another, which is another adaptation by Anderson of a Thomas Pynchon novel. Pynchon being one of the great American writers of the 20th and 21st century, and notorious for his books being very difficult to be adapted. Mm. Anderson did Inherent Vice about 12, 14 years ago. Not one of my favourites of Anderson's films, but this is the biggest budget that Anderson has ever worked with, $140 million.
How much?
$140 million. Do you want me to say that again, or did you
get
it? $140 million. With Leonardo in the cast.
Young Leo. That's his girlfriend, sorry.
Not anymore. Benicio del Toro, Sean Penn, Regina Hall, and it's the story of a 1960s sort of revolutionary radical group getting back together to fight the authorities when one of their number has their child kidnapped by the American Secret Service. $140 million. I mean, Paul Anderson's films are not big box office. They get brilliant critical receptions.
No, we were talking about this earlier, weren't we? And they keep spending this money, and I don't know who's going to spend the money on the tickets.
Yes. I mean, to break even, it's going to have to make...
It's going to have to make,
knocking on for $250-260 million.
Has he got that pun anymore, Leo?
I hope not. He's not looking good. He's looking a bit... Well, I think he's always looked a bit seedy, actually.
And I've never really got the whole... Leo.
I've never understood it. Never understood it. But apparently... he's worth $140 million, it would seem.
Oh, well, he can bail him out if it don't work then, doesn't he?
I'm sure he can.
I don't think this film's out for quite a while. It's not out until
September,
like,
I think it's coming
it?
Out. Yeah. It's been shot in VistaVision.
Ow.
So it's another one of these films where they're going back to this old format, and so it'll be interesting to see what it looks like. You can't quite work whether it's an action movie...
Or a little bit of comedy.
Or a comedy from the trailer. Benicio del Toro is wacky in the trailer, anyway.
There's a bit where he goes into a secret and the mat comes over.
And
the
he's
top
got a thing
like,
that pulls
oh,
the mat over his head. Yeah.
Looks fun.
I was in stitches.
Yeah.
After that depressing opening to the show, it's hopefully only getting better.
Yeah, now I'm going to bring you on to my music choices for this week. I was inspired by going to see The End. I wanted to, I thought, made me think of another unlikely musical that came out in 2021. And it's Leo Carax's Annette, for which was the brainchild of Sparks. And they provide the soundtrack. I'm going to start off with the opening number from that.
Hit it.
So, may we start?
So may we start.
My time to start.
One, two, three, four. Start. It's time to start. My time to start. They hope that it goes the way it's supposed to go. There's fear in them all, but they can't let it show. They're underprepared, but that may be enough. The budget is large, but still, it's not enough.
So may we start.
So may we start.
It's time to start.
May we start.
Well, as openings go for a musical, that's pretty good.
That was a great opening. What was that?
The CD's on the wrong setting, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Isn't it? What have you got to do?
Oh, I'll sort it out in a minute.
All right. I'll leave that with you.
Yeah.
A great opening, but I was saying to you earlier, I can't remember a thing about anything else about that film.
Well, I was really taken by it. So it's Adam Driver, Marion Cotillard.
Ah, that's it, Adam Driver.
Yeah, you're not a fan. Not a fan of the Driver.
No.
I love that opening of that film. If you're not familiar with it, basically it starts off. The director is sat in the sound booth of a recording studio. Sparks are in there, supposedly about to record this song. And then the camera just follows them. They walk out onto the street. They meet the cast. And it's like, here, you're going to watch our film now. Was it all happening in one shot? It was a little bit, yes.
We'll come back to that later on.
Yeah. There was a cut away from, like, the director at the sound desk. But yeah, it's like one tracking shot as they walk out of the... But it's funny because Marion Cotillard looks like the jolly young actress and Adam Driver looks like this is the 15th take we've done and I'm not doing it again. But it's not for everyone, this film. It depends how much you like your musicals or anti-musicals even. But the story is... Adam Driver is a famous comedian, shock comedian. He is also quite toxic and bad news for women. He is in love with Marion Cotillard, who is an opera singer, Anne. And they have a baby, Annette, who is a puppet. And yes, bad things happen. But it's a magical...
I'm sure you're all rushing out to get that on a DVD right now, aren't you?
It depends how much you like that kind of thing, but I just got swept up by it. I didn't really like the bits with Adam Driver's stand-up. I found that far too awkward.
He's just on stage
with like these horrible slipper moccasin things, a green dressing gown, and he's chomping on a banana and smoking a cigarette at the same time, which you'd think isn't possible. I love the colour of it. I love the songs in it. I love that Sparks appear. I love that it's funny. But there's a line in that song that says, the budget is very large, but not enough. Well, the budget for this was somewhere in the region of 16 million. The box office that they made on it was under 4. So I'm not sure he'll be doing another English language film anytime soon.
Carrick's is... he's a director. He's only made 6 feature films. Mm. He's done a lot of other work, shorts and music videos. But he sort of exploded onto the French cinema scene in the 1980s as the enfant terrible of his time. With and 3 films which he made in relatively quick succession,
which you then thought would be like lots more to come.
Boy Meets Girl, Mauvais Sang, and The Lovers of the Pont Neuf.
And Lovers of the Pont-Neuf, I was obsessed by.
That's an amazing film. But so is Mauvais Song.
That's the one with the tracking shot of the running down... What's the song that's playing?
Is Modern Love.
Modern Love, yeah.
And it really sort of leaps out. Mm. It comes out of nowhere. And all of these 3 films all star Denis Lavant. Mm. And they're referred to as the Alex trilogy. I think his character's always called Alex in each of the films. This moment in Mauvais Song is quite a touchstone moment. Lavant just runs down this street and he's running, he's dancing in a fashion, he's almost like just hurling himself down this street while the Bowie track blares out. And several years later, Noah Baumbach,
Francis,
either copied it or paid homage to it in Francis Ha, and he has Greta Gerwig do a very similar dash in New York Street.
But Leo Carax himself is very much, although he's an auteur, he's very much a cineast, and he's
got
all of his nods to other directors in there as well.
Yeah.
There's a similar Alex scene in Les Amants de Pont-Neuf, isn't there, where they're running around on the bridge. Juliette Binoche is in her yellow tracksuit.
With her eye patch.
Yeah.
There's something about a woman in an eye patch. It always appeals to me for some strange reason.
But what, that, I mean, the budget for that film, Les Amants de Pont-Neuf, was like broke the French bank, didn't
it? I think when it was first released, it was the most expensive French film ever made, because they rebuilt the Pont-Neuf Bridge in a studio and also had like scaled down backgrounds. So it's like La Samaritaine department store was at one. And I think the bridge was undergoing renovations. So
yeah, I went on that bridge in 1998.
Yeah.
I was like, Chrissy, we're on the bridge 9. She's like, I don't know what you're talking about and why you're so excited. It's just a bridge.
And it's a strange film because it starts off with this like, really graphic documentary footage of down and outs in a, well, what we used to call a doss house, isn't it? Washing and it's really sort of grim. And then, I don't know, about an hour later, they're water skiing down the Seine. There's fireworks going off, music playing.
Oh, because it's the anniversary of independence,
the French Revolution,
isn't it?
Yeah. It's an extraordinary film. Mm. And
I struggled to get hold of it on a Blu-ray or DVD not that long ago. I was trying to... I asked for a copy for Christmas. And someone bought me one, but it was a French... There's no English translation on it.
I do have a DVD of it with subtitles. Mm. I think what was the other one? Polar X was a...
Yeah, I'm not familiar.
It's a difficult film. I don't even want to start going into what it's about because I'll just be scratching my head. But it has a almost like cacophonous score by Scott Walker. And again, I've only watched it once because I've only had the courage, I think, to sit through it once. You sure with the CD player? That's it. Can I stop talking now?
No. I was. We haven't mentioned Holy Motors yet.
Oh God, Holy Motors! Yeah, that was.
I mean, that is the Kylie film.
But that was a film I just saw. I was watching it. I thought, I hate this film. Absolutely hate it. And then this is an entr'acte, and an intermission occurs, and there's this just thing that comes out of nowhere. This you can only call it an accordion orchestra, which walk around or storm around this church playing this accordion based version of an R.L. Burnside blues song, Let My Baby Ride. And what was that?
I find it intriguing that you got into this film at the intermission as well.
Exactly. And then the rest of the film I absolutely adored. And when it was over, I was watching it on a DVD, I started watching it from the beginning straight away and
I love it when a film can change your mind about it mid-film.
And I like films like that where you think, what is this about? And just something, and it can be a scene, it can just be one scene, or it can be a couple of shots, or an actor appears who hasn't been in it yet or something. And I love that thing of having like the carpet pulled from beneath your feet. So that's, and Denis Levant is in that as well.
But there's always these themes of the love between people being like not being dangerous and being edgy, and like this, there's an obsessive nature to the love in these films that isn't healthy.
Not healthy at all. It sometimes results in death. Mm-hmm. If you've seen Boy Meets Girl, it's a very, very tragic ending.
Or Annette.
Yes.
Shall I play another song? Yeah, I know you can't wait.
look, I don't mind this because I love Sparks. All I'm saying is the film of Annette, I don't think... I might go in and watch the opening scene again and then I'll be straight out.
Well, this this scene is sort of, he's kind of like love bombing her really and making her feel like he's the only person for her and surrounding her in this world. And it's one of those songs, it's called We Love Each Other So Much, but it really, really captures for me the nauseating nature of a couple obsessed with each other who think they're the first people to ever have sex with each other, basically.
Get a room.
We love each other so much. We love each other so much. Scoffing at logic, this wasn't the plan. We love each other so much.
We love each other so much. We love each other.
Yes, we back?
Yeah.
Yes, we are.
Yeah, yeah.
You're listening to The Film Show on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM, and on digital. And we've got to try and raise our spirits and of our listener, who's texting in, wanting a number for the Samaritans after the show.
Have you got anything cheery?
Well, I was very happy to find out that it's... 20 years, would you believe it, since director Ondi Timana unleashed her amazing
notorious
documentary, Dig, which is about the rivalry between two bands who took their names from seminal figures of the 1960s, the Brian Jonestown Massacre and the Dandy Warhols. And she filmed this over 7 years of following both bands around. And they're like a very sort of chalk and cheese pair of bands, both based in the Pacific Northwest. The Brian Jonestown Massacre, led by a obsessive, maniacal, drug-addled genius called Anton Newcombe, who can sometimes chuck out 3 albums in a year, ruin every opportunity they ever have at industry gigs to get them big record deals, and have a streak of self-destruction, or at least Newcombe has a streak of self-destruction a mile wide down his back. You will see such unbelievable performances of, you know, utter self, just self-destruction. And then you have the Dandy Warhols, who are champing at the bit to have someone spend $400,000 on them to make a video of a crap single that they've just made. They are such servile, horrible people.
I was going to say, it's one of those things that just puts you up. You think you like musicians and music, and then you see this and go, oh, yeah, oh my God, hideous. So.
And this film is amazing because a lot of it is narrated by the Dandy Warhols, Courtney Taylor. And when it first started off, I hadn't really heard of the Brian Jonestown Massacre. And I hated the Dandy Warhols by the end of this film. And Courtney Taylor is such an arse, I have to say. All he wants to be is Anton Newcombe. He's desperate to be Anton Newcombe, and he just can't do it. And sometimes you think, does Anton want to be Courtney? But he'd just self-destruct again as soon as he tried to be in front of the cameras for a $400,000 video performance. It's an amazing film, but to make this for 7 years, and I think this is what's really interesting about documentaries, when do you stop filming?
Yeah, well, when do you know it's over? You don't.
You're not making a historical. You're making a fly on the wall. And at the end of the film, the original version of Dig, it looks as though the band has split up and Anton's been arrested, I think, for not paying alimony or something like that, and he's being put in the police car and driven away. And as I didn't know much about him at that time, I thought, oh, right, that's it. And literally, a few months later, they were playing at the Lead Mill. And me and my friend got tickets to see it, and we went into the Rutland. And Anton was at the bar of the Rutland.
Going, how much for a pint?
Knocking back a pint. And we said to him, it was like an early start at 8 o'clock. So I said, aren't you supposed to be on? He went, oh, don't worry about it. But, you know, you could see he'd had a drink, but he looked as though he was capable. And we went down, we saw this gig. They were on for 2 hours in the bar, not on the big stage, in the bar. And they did the most transcendent two-hour set that I have ever seen.
What?
I was absolutely blown away by them. And the Lead Mill, to their undying shame, turned off the power at 10 o'clock because they wanted it the club night in. I think the Brian Jonestown Massacre are the most frustrating, most incredible band. And I've been to see them once where all Anton did was order people off stage and moan at everybody in the band. And it was going on and on and on for 20 minutes. If, oh, for God's sake, just play a song. And then they just launched into this number called Golden Frost, and it was incredible. Again, they took the roof of the place off, and you pay your money, you take a chance when you see them. But this new version's got 40 minutes extra footage in, and it is really good.
The original documentary but with an update?
It's the original documentary with more in. Right. I haven't quite got to the end yet.
More in of the morons.
But but I do think you see as to what some of them are doing now.
Yeah.
But there's lots more. There's a bit where Harry Dean Stanton joins them in one of their squats and they jam with Harry Dean Stanton. There's a lot more of Courtney Taylor being vile, but there you are.
So where is this on?
Well, there was a couple of screenings, I think, this week, one-night screenings.
Right.
If you want to watch it, it's on Amazon Prime.
Oh, right.
And if you want to buy it, you can only buy it, but it's $7.99.
So there's some laughs in it, would you say?
It's hilarious. I mean, there is just such unbelievable. Imagine when the Georgia Police Department stop them on the road. Have you got anything in there you shouldn't have? You soon find the answer to that. It's cheered me up enormously anyway.
Well, I was cheered up by my film this week. So I went to see The End last night, having watched a two-hour documentary about the military dictatorship in Indonesia.
Indonesian death squads.
That was fun. So Oppenheimer cited Jack Demme's Umbrellas of Cherbourg as an inspiration for this. It's not sung the whole way through, but there are some mundane singing bits in between. But you've basically got unnamed characters, a father, Michael Shannon, a mother, Tilda Swinton, a son, George. Still don't know how to say poor old George's name. I'm going to say McKay, who I absolutely adore as an actor. I think he's made some really interesting choices. He was in The Beast last year, which was one of my absolute favourites from last year.
The Ned Kelly film, he was brilliant as well.
Yeah, he's just, and even 1917, I just find him a really intelligent, intuitive actor, and he makes this really watchable, I think, because it's a bit of a tough sell, this one. So it's 2.5 hours for starters, and I hate to start a review by going, this is how long you'll be sat in your seat. But there's possibly a reason that the screening I was in last night, it was the first night it was on. There was me and 7 or 8 others, but everyone was single. I don't believe all these people were single. I just believe they knew not to bring someone else with them. Because that was my experience.
They gone with someone and they were now sitting in different parts of the cinema?
But it reminded me, actually, I took Chris to see a stage show of Umbrellas of Cherbourg once, and I patiently sat through the whole thing, started clapping at the end. And as he was clapping, the applause at the end, he leaned into me and he just went, if you ever bring me to anything like this again, I'm leaving you. Clap, clap, clap. And I was like, okay, this would be a deal breaker. I think this would be quite divisive. I loved it, but I was getting this sense in the back of my head of who else is this for? So they're basically stuck in a bunker in a salt mine. The father, it's 25 years after some kind of apocalyptic event has meant that the Earth is unlivable on. Somehow they have got this bunker. And I've read a lot of reviews where they've said, oh, it's palatial. It's not. They're surrounded by luxury items. I have no idea where young George, who's born down there, gets all his wardrobe from.
It's 25 years out of date, isn't it?
But they have a lab and they have a kitchen and they have, you know, they've brought down a minimal number of people. They haven't saved many people, like friends and family. They've got a friend, Brenna Gallagher, who's fantastic in this. They've bought a butler, who is Tim McInerney.
Yeah.
Who is playing a sort of celibate gay man.
Yes. There's a push
and then
for Tim McInerney.
Lenny James is kind of this cynical doctor. Brona Gallagher is Tilda Swinton's friend, who is also their chef. So it's like they've brought them down, but everyone's got a function for them. They haven't brought them to save them. Mm. And they've had their son down there. And so George McKay plays this kind of... He's naive, obviously, because he's spent his whole life under there. And then they wander off into the salt bunkers and have a sing-song now and then, which is quite nice.
Could I just say to you, there is no way on earth I would ever enter a cinema where this was playing.
And I know you wouldn't, but I feel like other people will get something from this. I was totally...
An headache.
Yeah. I was totally captivated by it, especially... So the young woman that turns up is... I've forgotten her name. This is terrible. The end cast, let's have a look. Moses Ingram plays Girl. She not only comes and unsettles there... Because they're living with they're ignoring their guilt and their responsibility for the situation that, that the world is in and they are in, and the decisions that they've made to save themselves and not other people. And the boy, the son, is starting to, will be starting to question what's going on because this new person has come in. And the rule is that they don't accept new people because 20 years ago or something, some people tried to get in and there's nobody left anymore, it looks like. Moses Ingram not only comes in as this girl who makes the son question stuff, but she can sing.
So, thank God for that.
So some of the songs have got good singing on them. And I loved it. It doesn't hold up to scrutiny of like, where do they get their nice jumpers from? And where do, you know, don't just forget all that.
You can't always think that
forget
through.
Forget all that, yeah. It just, and look at it. And I thought it was visually beautiful, and it doesn't harm that mother collects all these artworks and they're just hanging up everywhere. And she obsesses about like keeping time with the season and having the place looking lovely because she's obsessed with, you know, what she's done. I highly rate it, but I struggle to recommend it because I know a lot of people would be like you and my boyfriend who will just go, I'm not sitting through that. And that's fine.
There's plenty of stuff. I'm not someone. There are certain things I just don't like.
Yeah.
And this is. Remember, I go and see Bela Tarr films. You know, those defeated you. I'll be very brief. I'm just going to talk briefly about the new TV series on Apple Plus, film related, The Studio. Which is Seth Rogen as a film studio executive who's promoted to be in the CEO and has to put away his artistic pretensions or instincts to run a studio for money. And it's very, very knowing. It has lots of real-life people playing versions of themselves, such as Paul Dano as an actor called Paul, Sarah Polley as a director called Sarah, people popping up and down all the time through it. It's Martin Scorsese turns up as a director. Or they do say Martin Scorsese, but, you know, Scorsese would turn up to the opening of a fridge door, wouldn't he? So it's no big deal if you've got Martin Scorsese in. It's tediously done with... The first episode is a series of one-take, you know, mobile shot, oneers, that they call them. The second episode is one single oneer. And I was saying last week... I've just had enough of it. It's no big deal anymore. And the biggest curse in cinema is digital, because if you put a roll of film in, it used to run out. And that's how Altman did that great shot with the player.
The opening shot when he's arriving at the studio.
The opening shot goes all the way around and she introduces you to all these characters. I'm sorry, but it's just enough. Enough, please. I'm saying no more.
Put the cuts in for Martin, please.
Cuts. Establishing shot would be good there. Thank you.
Well, I'm going to give one quick brief review, not even a full review, but I saw When Autumn Falls, which is continuing this week, the new Francois Ozon film, do I want to say? Gosh, forgotten the chap's name now. I'm doing Ozon. Ozon. This film has got about three different names, wherever you look at it, but it seems to have been translated in different ways. But it's called When Autumn Falls here, but you might see it called When Fall Is Coming elsewhere as well. When Fall Falls. Spring forward, fall back. Oh, clocks change this weekend. Sorry. Mind change. It stars Helen Vincent as a sort of 70-ish granny who goes mushroom picking, accidentally poisons her daughter, gets stopped from seeing her son, and it turns into this really weird little thriller, and I quite liked it, and I suggest catching that if you can.
Sounds good. A Francois Ozon film is always worth your money.
Yeah, absolutely, and it sort of doesn't always do what you're expecting it to do narratively. And it looks fabulous.
And that guy works, doesn't he?
I feel like I just reviewed one of his last film, 2 months ago or something. Right, another song. Here we go. There you go. If you wondered what Spark's song about giving birth would sound like to a puppet, there you go.
There you go.
She's out of this world.
Wonder no more.
From the Annette.
Okay, next week.
Well, you can't wait for the Minecraft movie, I know.
I would like to pick it, cinema's showing it.
I'm going to break it to you now, listeners. You ain't going to get a review of that next week. Nope. Mr. Burton's out. There's a French film called Miss Cordia out. Four Mothers looks like a fun Irish film about a guy who's left with three of his friends' mother while they go off to a pride event in Spain. It won the Audience Award at the British Film Festival, I think. And that looks fun. They're showing it for Mother's Day as well tomorrow. And there's also Death of the
Unicorn. Is it Mother's Day tomorrow?
Yeah! Oh, no! I'm going to leave you with one more Annette. We love you, Annette. And Martin loves Adam Driver. We'll see you next week. Enjoy your films.
Annette and me and the conductor are three. We're traveling round the world. 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 We're traveling round the world.
Ladies and gentlemen, please make sure your seats are in the upright position. We'll be landing shortly.
Here in Madrid,
we love Annette.
Here in Paris,
we love Annette.
Here in London,
we love Annette. 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 We love Annette.
We're traveling round the world. We're traveling round the world. We're traveling round the world.